Hello and welcome to this PSG Think Big series podcast. In this program, Alicia Seckham speaks to Dr. Frans Cronier on South Africa, the narrative versus the numbers.
Hello and welcome to the Think Big series brought to you by PSG. As you've come to know by now, the series is a collection of dialogues with leading speakers that aims to bring its audiences independent insights on some of our country's most pressing issues. And today we're talking South Africa, the narrative versus the numbers. This in the context of popular misconceptions about the South African landscape, both political and economic. Now, undoubtedly, the country's up against a myriad of challenges. Instability within the GNU, still crumbling infrastructure in key municipalities, Budget 3.0, and on the international scene, turbulent relations with the US adding to the woes, stifling the country's economic growth. And no doubt it's triggering concern, anxiety, frustration around the where to from here for the country. But beyond the emotion, what's the data saying? And how should the country be leveraging that data to come up with appropriate solutions to change the trajectory it's currently on? Joining me in conversation is political and economic analyst Frans Cronier, who is director of Frans Cronier Private Clients and chairman of the board at the Social Research Foundation. Frans, thanks so much for joining us today. Now, I'm going to get straight into it, right? Because you look beyond the day-to-day headlines, working with various kinds of data sets as you advise corporations and government agencies alike on South African and global strategic risk. But a number you've been particularly loud about, South Africa's fixed investment sitting at only 15% of GDP, because what it costs us is growth. South African growth at 1% versus emerging markets on average growing at about 4% and generally investing 25% of GDP or more. So why is South Africa still lagging to the extent that it is, as you see it?
Well, I think that's the key number to watch now to see where the country goes. If you offered me only one for the next decade, said you've got one indicator on the back of that, tell us what happened to the country, I'd pick this number. Now, it's sitting at around 15% of GDP. Now, that's about half of where it should be. Emerging markets are generally averaging levels of around 25, perhaps approaching 30% of GDP. At 15% of GDP, it's perfectly consistent with South Africa's economic growth rate of around 1% and a bit. If we want to lift the rate of economic growth to 4% and perhaps above that, threatening 5%, then we've got to close this fixed investment gap. So that means lifting it by at least 10 percentage points to 25%. Now, there's some history here, of course, because in the first half of the era after 1994, that's exactly what started to happen. The ANC, on coming to power, inherits a very low rate of fixed investment. They drive the number into the 20s, and it even starts to threaten that 25% level before being interrupted by the global financial crisis. In the process of doing so, and this is forgotten, the rate of economic growth through the first, let's say, 15 years after 94 lifts from, you know, the very volatile numbers of the 1980s and early 90s to 2 and then 3 and then 4%. And then between 2004 and 2007, as fixed investment peaked, we hit a growth rate of 5% of GDP. We averaged that for 4 consecutive years. And on the back end of that era, 94 to 2007, this is forgotten, it's critically important. South Africa essentially doubles the number of people in employment. A vast lift in basic living standards is brought about at the same time by the social protection net, which has become so expansive. A net financed, we must remember, by savings on the government's interest bill, because government debt to GDP has been halved, and with that, obviously, the government interest bill. The consequence of which is, by around 2007, 2008, we've doubled the number of people in employment. Living standards are sharply up. We've recorded the first multi-year surpluses since the formation of the Union. And the politics has become very stable. Levels of violent protest action are way down, and the ANC is at 70% in an election. So this has to be the key marker. Take it back to 25%. South Africa has a very successful and prosperous future on the back end of that.
And of course, one of the ways to do that, Frans, is to implement economic policy supportive of that, as opposed to policies that just aren't investor friendly, right? Especially where you say you've got data at hand reflecting that the majority of South Africans and within the ANC itself does support a more moderate, pragmatic and centrist approach. So before I ask you to tackle the question, why then ideology is seemingly still trumping practicality and what practical policy solutions we should be looking at, give us a sense of the data pool being sampled.
Well, if it depends on the fixed investment number, it's obviously the macro South African economy. And later through this talk, we might go into some narrower political numbers. And in that regard, I do chair one of the country's polling groups. And large scale samples for us will be about 3,200 or so. At that point, what matters is the margin of error. By what share are you off? And you can't really do much better than margins of error of around 2%. And at samples of 3,200, you're there. And even if you increase those substantially, you won't get much beyond that. But let me answer your question, which I haven't done yet. It's not difficult. So don't despair about South Africa. We're not in raising the fixed investment rate, trying to do something that no other country has ever achieved. In fact, we're just trying to do what every other emerging market does without too much difficulty. It's not hard. Three things. Number one is the question of energy. Into the next decade, South Africa has more than enough installed energy generating capacity in the defunct coal fleet to make a growth rate of 4 or 5% of GDP possible. All that needs to be done is the refitting of those plants. Now, that runs into the global green lobby. It runs into the Europeans. It won't run into opposition from the Trump administration either. And all the South Africans need to say is, listen, in our unique circumstances, with this new young democracy that we've got, just give us a break. Let us do the transition to clean energy on our own terms. Do not put pressure on South Africa to back off on coal. And do not oppose South Africa's efforts to refit parts of the defunct coal fleet. If we do that, there will be no energy ceiling on future rates of economic growth into the end of this decade, number one. The second thing to do is don't tax capital on arrival into the country. This is one of the key factors that deters investment and contributes to that low number. So if a firm wishes to commit to South Africa, a large entity or a small one, risk capital and build plant and equipment in South Africa, judge the empowerment responsibilities in a slightly different way. The real building blocks of empowerment are fixed investment, tax payments, employment and exports, and just tweak the approach to empowerment to say that's what we want to count or audit as the South Africans, more than just narrow racial criteria. Do that, and one of the great impediments to fixed investment is removed. Now, I also think we're going to see South Africa go this way. My sense of it is, particularly given recent events in the United States, that you're going to start to see this happen in the communication sector. And that may open the way to it happening in other sectors as well.
Yeah.
The third thing to do is the question of property rights. They have to be 100% secure. There is no policy in South Africa called the Land Expropriation Act. There's a piece of expropriation policy that allows the seizure of any fixed or movable asset without market-related compensation. Nil is a red herring, just as land is. That needs to be tweaked to say that in the event of an expropriation, the primary issue, a consideration that a court will weigh in deciding on compensation is market value. And that in a free and open society and a modern industrial economy, it is just and equitable that expropriated owners get market value for assets that are expropriated. Should South Africa do those three things, the refitment of coal, the reworking of the empowerment scorecard, and lock in market value in the event of an expropriation, then you will see a lift in the fixed investment rate. It will be a very rapid lift. We might talk later about America. I'll make some of those points then. It might be a very rapid rate. You'll see the rate of growth lift on the back of the fixed investment number on a very short lag time. And how's this? If South Africa's rate of unemployment officially now just over 30%, in practice it's over 40%, for young people it's over 50%. The world's rate is 5%. If we go to a growth rate of 4% of GDP, and if we hold that for 20 years, we will bring the unemployment rate down to 10%. And then we will take out of the country a lot of the energy behind populist politicking. Yeah. And we will be increasingly prosperous. People will live in much better circumstances. Politically, we'll remain free and open, and we will be a pretty prosperous and pretty stable corner of the world, the sort of envy of other emerging markets. So the point, just, it's not, don't despair that these things can't be done. They are not difficult to do, and the results will follow very quickly on the back of doing.
Yeah. And of course, it's significant, right, that we had pushback on something like Budget 2025, for example, Frans. So how significant is that in your books? The fact that, version 1 and 2 weren't accepted before we've now settled on Budget 3.0, because this possibly the first instance where the GNU's negotiating muscle or power showing through, underlining that, what's been said before, I guess, that cabinet is now no longer a rubber stamp to just any economic policy, but policy that is practical and that stands to benefit national interest.
Yeah, this is a great case study. Remember, we go back just actually quite a long way. For the last 400 years, the territory that's today the modern South Africa, wherever you were within that territory, there was probably a single political actor who had the power to decide what the rules of the game were. And about 300 days ago, that changed for the first time. It had never happened before that the governing authority, whatever it was, actually had to talk to its former competitor and find a middle ground. And that was very new for the people involved as well. Suddenly consensus had to be found. Countries, when they change, do so through one of two ways, democratically and chaotically, or violently, where people are shot in the streets. We are in the fortunate minority of post-colonial emerging markets that are changing peacefully and democratically. We became a democratic society so that if a point was reached where the country wasn't well governed to the advantage of all its people, they would do something about it. That is all that happened in the election in 2024. The system worked exactly as it was intended. And don't despair too much if you see the politicians argue with each other in Parliament, delay the budget by a month or two. And remember, the alternative is shooting in the streets. And these parties, as I've observed them, certainly learned a lot out of this budgeting experience. There's a bit of a misnomer, I think, in the Western world that finding mutual common ground and understanding is the best way to make progress. There's an alternative view that politics is about power and forcing balances of power. And my sense of it has been from the start of the GNU that when the key partners to South Africa's government realize that each has some power, and that they are willing to use that power to force a certain position. That's the point at which real progress can be made towards policy reform. So I think a very important moment. Yes. I think it's actually remarkable that it was resolved as effectively as it was and how quickly it was. And just in those moments where the politicians might make you irate, remember, 400 years of one system changed just 300 days ago. And the more these politicians see of each other, the more they interact. In the event the ANC doesn't go back to a majority, which it very easily might, maybe a point to touch on later, I think it was the system working exactly as it was intended and was actually a very good thing.
So, Franz, let's extrapolate from that, right, and now take things into the international arena. How have you then digested the talks happening stateside, given the local economic and political landscape and our vulnerabilities? Because up to this point, very mixed reviews are coming through.
Okay, let's, you know, if you get sucked into the soap opera drama of it all, it's a very deep, dark hole that you get down. So again, I'm just going to pull it back a bit. The South Africans that speak as detached analysts have a growth rate of 1% and unemployment rate of 30%. To change that, they need to close a fixed investment gap of 10 percentage points. Where does the capital for that come from? A large part of the answer is potentially the United States. The Assistant Secretary, the Acting Assistant Secretary for Africa, said about 10 days ago that American diplomacy in Africa is now commercial diplomacy, and its diplomats will be judged by the deals they do, the value of those deals, the number of deals, and the reforms they press for that enable those deals. So, and the Americans are under pressure in that regard, because in terms of their own fixed investment number on Africa, they're a bit behind where they want to be. China's nudging ahead, which Americans don't like. And Americans, in my seeing of them, have shifted how Africa is regarded from somewhere where you come to give aid and to help the people of Africa to somewhere of great strategic importance. You know, Africa now has more cities of 1 million inhabitants than Europe and America combined. Those cities are in economies that are amongst the fastest growing in the world. They're the last great untapped consumer market. They 50 votes on global forums, such as the UN, for example. So there's a very strong strategic American interest in lifting its levels of fixed investment. South Africa is eminently investable for Americans. Democracy, free and open society, deep liquid capital markets by African standards, excellent banking system, a good infrastructure, and a very high standard of living for expats. And South Africa's, the symbiosis is obvious to anyone who would look at it. And in that regard, Mr. Trump's interest in the country, which seems significant, is an asset to be exploited. I mean, when the most powerful man in the world, now Donald Trump, and the richest, Mr. Musk, both spend some time of every week thinking about you, you can probably turn that to your advantage. There's another point to make, which is South Africa has a particular strategic importance, which is perhaps the country's most valuable asset. We were born, South Africans, as a young democracy, into an essentially unipolar world. The Cold War was over, the Soviet Union had collapsed, China wasn't yet seen for what it would become. 30 years later, we're in a multipolar world. There are competing power blocks. And in a multipolar world, to command geostrategic influence, choke points are very important. And choke points are essentially commercial or naval shipping passages that narrow. Now, the Southern Sea route is one of the most important over the past several hundred years. The Houthis in Yemen firing some Rockets into the Red Sea have diverted shipping around the Cape at a rate that is equivalent to what happened after the fall of Hong Kong and Singapore in the Second World War. The Americans understand that Simonstown, the naval base, is one of 3 points that now anchors control of the Indo-Pacific, through which more than half of global trade that travels by sea passes. They're in some trouble on some of the other points, the Solomon Islands off the east coast of Australia, and the Bab el-Mandab Strait, where the Red Sea narrows, and where you narrow into the Red Sea and beyond that Suez. So it's very important. Simonstown is also the back door into the South Atlantic. Now, Mr. Trump's abiding foreign policy objective is a zone of hegemonic Western influence, American influence in the Western Hemisphere. And he talks about Greenland as much as he does because you get into the Western Hemisphere through Greenland and it's vulnerable. And he talks about Panama for the same reason. But the back door is Simonstown. And if it takes rudimentary skilled diplomacy to take America's fixed investment interests, South Africa's, and South Africa's strategic importance in Simonstown, and play those cards into the form of a new bilateral investment treaty that will singularly lift the rate of fixed investment to a point that it actually shifts, moves the dial on growth and therefore job creation. So I don't see the domestic position on SA in the same pessimistic terms as others of my other analysts. And I don't see what's transpired in America, if you can stay away from the soap opera level of it, as negative at all. I think it's a vast opportunity for this young unity government that they will be able to take advantage of if they adopt the correct strategies in doing so.
Okay, so Franz, on the one hand, the argument is that South Africa needs to plug a fixed investment gap and that the US can potentially do that. On the other, that South Africa should not be bullied. The US does have an interest in Africa and it needs to leverage that position more so, that it should not go, hat in hand and overcompromise, I guess, if you can call it that. There's a lot of theories around what's driving our US policy right now. What should be driving it if we're considering South Africa's national interest?
Well, what should be driving it is really a rehash of and certainly the advice we gave ahead of the Oval Office meeting that happened recently, was to say, go into it and say, we wish to build with you a new bilateral investment treaty that's mutually beneficial. Bullying doesn't come into it in that case. We need that for our democracy to survive and thrive. That's not a question of turning our backs on China. I'm a strong advocate of China and Africa. I think what China's done in lifting billions of people out of dire poverty is extraordinary, and there's a lot to learn from it. It doesn't mean alienating or isolating Russia. Russia's an increasingly important player in Africa. It's positioned itself as that. So you chase the French out of West Africa, for just one example. And South Africa's foreign policy should simply say to our Western allies, listen, the demand isn't to alienate China or Russia from the Americans, I can assure you. We wish to build a new bilateral investment treaty. Concrete terms. This is what we need to do on agriculture. This is what we need to do on infrastructure. This is what we need to do on coal refitment. This is potentially what we need to do on mining. How many shafts have been sunk, mining shafts in South Africa in the last 20 years? It's appallingly few, given the country's mineral resources. And then so the concrete offer on the bilateral investment treaty, and then to say it extends beyond that to a new transatlantic partnership. We wish for that partnership. We wish to be in a partnership that is the US, the UK, South Africa, and Argentina. The Argentinians are very popular in America at the moment. We wish to play a key role in that. If that message is put across, but in concrete terms, it will meet with a very positive reception in America. And I don't see that. This is mutually beneficial to both countries. There's not It's not a bullying situation. But we mustn't be complacent. The US has fallback positions in Southern Africa. It's the Trump administration's deeply committed to seeking ways to invest in South Africa. The best advice I've had on him is to take him seriously, but not literally. So, you know, as I think many people will learn.
Yeah.
The Americans have fallback positions in Namibia. Namibia is an extremely interesting and important country. The oil find off the Namibian coastline might be one of the most spectacular in history. With some colleagues in Windhoek, some very interesting estimates have been produced that multiply per capita GDP. Never seen numbers like that. It's flat Namibia. It's peaceful. Its press freedom ranking is better than Canada. You can build infrastructure into Africa. It's got the deep water port at Walvis Bay. It's a fantastic option. And I think I hold the view, here's a punt for you. Namibia potentially becomes one of Africa and later the world's most influential economies. North of that, the Americans have fantastic options in Angola and the Lobito Corridor. So from the South African side, the complacency would be a mistake now. The correct move would be concrete bilateral investment treaty offer. This is it. And South African firms into America, that would be welcome. And extend that to the offer of a new transatlantic partnership. And we'll be away. And America won't, in and of itself, plug the investment gap. But it will go a long way to doing so. And the lift in confidence as a consequence will be extremely important to drawing in other investment, let alone unlocking South African investor capital that is itself concerned at the prospect for the country and therefore wary of committing fully to South Africa at this time.
Absolutely. It's a recalibration, right? And we've seen on some fronts how this has worked, you know, how adapting policy, for example, with private sector locally can work to turn things around with the impact PPPs are having on the energy space, for one, and that are concrete working examples of how, you know, you leverage relationships in your favor with both parties deriving benefit for the greater good.
Yeah. And these things, I mean, just to reiterate, these things are easy to do. Countries don't have 30% unemployment rates. We're unique in that. Countries don't have these low levels of fixed investment. If we had done everything in our power and we were still there, and we were a country bereft of resources, without skills, with no infrastructure, with no financial system to convey investment one way and another, that a radicalized population, a no democratic institutions, then maybe you can start to despair on South Africa's prospect. But really, I mean, we're a thriving democracy. We have phenomenal infrastructure by emerging market standards. Some of the most skilled people are entrepreneurs in the world. And vast interest from the world's great powers in having a piece of that. It really isn't difficult to trade that position to a point where your growth rate is 4%. And then, as I said, we knock unemployment back over 20 years to 10 and we're fine.
Yeah.
And I raised the point that I'll develop. I said we're not a radicalized population. Don't be misled by some of what you pick up from kind of popular media, social media or whatever, that South Africa is a country divided against itself. I've polled on South Africa for 20 years. We are comfortably a country where 7 to 8 out of 10 people share broadly the same values of decency, of hard work, of law and order, of valuing education and the like. It's extraordinary, in fact, the extent to which those values extend across lines of politics or ideology or socioeconomics or age or race or any of those things. And sometimes if pressed on South Africa, I might say to an audience, The most powerful countervailing force in favor of the country's success is the common sense of the great majority of its citizens, which is extraordinary if you think of the history and the continuing economic exclusion that we're not a radicalized population. And the data points are very, I might not go into them in detail now, but they are extremely uplifting to read.
Yeah.
So again, I just, you know, maybe just helps to shift perceptions a bit that these things that are often presented as insurmountable, how will we ever get the policies right to grow? Well, it's not difficult. How will we ever overcome the attacks of the Americans on us? Well, there's a huge opportunity there. How do we deal with the historical legacy? Well, in fact, the value systems of different South Africans are very closely aligned. And really, to reiterate that, it's on when you've assembled all of these, let's call them countervailing forces, you can argue, as I do for you now, that there is a serious prospect that South Africa becomes one of the world's most successful societies.
And Franz, that's a good place to leave it. Thanks so much for having joined us on the Think Big series and for your invaluable insights and sharing them with us today. To our audience, thank you for having joined us as well. Just a reminder, the social media campaign is #ThinkBigPSG. And because the series is free, is shareable and open to anyone interested, whether you're a PSG client or not, feel free to keep the conversation going on the various social media platforms. From me, Alicia Seckham, it's goodbye until next time.